This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 298 for the week of April 13th, 2020. I am Pricey Roomlet, David T. Cole, and I'm here with 33rd Missed Call, Sarah D. Bunting.
Can you hear me now?
Dangerously competent assistant, Tara Ariano.
Welcome to Chicago.
And Train in Vain, Dan Rogge.
Did you stand by me? No way.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us is our friend Dan Rogge. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Yay! We are here to talk about the new HBO limited series, which, as we know by now, could mean any fucking thing. Coming soon, season two of Chernobyl. Just kidding. Run. This is the new show, executive produced by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, but really from Vicky Jones, whose credits are Killing Eve, which she also did with PWB. Oh no, I broke Dave.
Okay, sorry, not to derail me, this already, but immediately it was called Chernobyl. Good grief, Charlie Brown. It's Chernobyl. And somehow Chernobyl melts down again, even though it's like Homer. There's no radioactive materials. Yeah, somehow it melts down again.
He did it, yeah.
That's season two.
Okay. Anyway, the show is called Run. The premise is this. Ruby, who's played by Merritt Weaver, and Billy, who's played by Donald Gleason, dated in college and then broke up. But they, at some point, established a deal whereby if one of them texts the other the word run, and the other responds also with the word run, then they will meet up in New York. They will get on a train. They will take a train ride across the country to Los Angeles. And at the end of it, decide whether they're going to stay together or never see each other again for the rest of their lives. So over the course of the first episode, which is the only one that has aired so far, we find out a few things about their lives, like he's had a meltdown in his job as a life coach. She is married and has kids. He has some other secrets, too, that he's not getting into. So that's where we're starting from. So leaving aside the possibility that taking a cross-country train trip with Mussolini might sound pretty good to some of us at this point in history, Dan, in a recent email, you indicated that Run did not work for you. Let's start with your macro reasons, then we can drill down to specifics. What were your big feelings about Run?
Yeah, and it's not that it didn't work for me so much. Well, let me go back even further, right?
Okay.
So, like, I feel like I'm the exact level of Phoebe Waller-Bridge fan you would expect from the average Extra Hot Great just listener, like early adopter of Fleabag, first season of Killing Eve, certain that the delay of the Bond movie is the worst news that's come out of the last month, right? So I had, like, all of the institutional knowledge that I felt I needed going into this show, but my expectations were thus very high. And for me, almost the opposite of what you said, the first barrier of entry after 30 plus days of quarantine in a New York City apartment was, oh good, a frenetic and stressful story told in a confined space, just what I was clamoring for right now. Like, my anxiety when they got on the train, it was like they had created Snowpiercer, the TV show. Like, I, like, literally couldn't breathe. And so I feel like that was my first small barrier for entry, and was wondering if that sort of impacted the initial viewing experience for anybody else.
Well, I can say this much. I'm pretty sure that Amtrak serves cockroaches in their snack bar. Because I've had some meals on Amtrak and... Oh.
Also, indeed. There is a Snowpiercer TV show. It is coming next month on TNT. That's not a joke.
Oh, no. I'll be back.
Sarah, we were also DMing a little bit with past and future guests of the show, David J. Roth, about this. You were not a super-duper fan of this either, was my impression.
Yeah, the more I watched it, the less I liked it. Mm-hmm. It's not the leads. Like, I think they're fine and they are doing the best they can with, implausible characters. Like,
yeah,
when, like, the premise is really cool and it's sort of like, all right, let's see how they pull this off. But then the more you learn about the characters and what they're actually running from, the less you believe that they would run, the less you believe the process of running. Like, never mind that her scene, her initial scene at LAX totally lost me. Like, I just don't. Like, she's carrying a tote bag and she rolls up to a ticket desk. This is like watching these scenes in like 90210 when whatever Dylan is getting a passenger manifest and you're like, what year that starts with nine is this? Because no. So that takes you out of it a little bit. And then once you realize that it's not just that she's married to Rich Summer, TV's worst husband.
Yep.
Delightful human in person, but always plays a douche. It's like, all right, I get it. I get why she's trying. She's texting this like every day to old Don't Hole. But once you find out that she has kids, it's like, I just don't buy this. I don't buy that this is the thought process. Mm-hmm. I don't, like, she's doing everything she can to invest this character. And as the episodes go by, you see more and more like darkness from both of them. Mm-hmm. But like, did anyone else on the panel believe that they could be this cocooned away from the internet and virality? Because there are several things in the plot that depend on their not really knowing anything about each other's internet lives, and it's not credible.
Yeah. Yes, that Billy wouldn't have looked her up on Facebook until they reconnected in person is not believable to me, especially given future episodes revelations about the history of their texting life, which we got to watch ahead. Future episodes we'll be careful about what we reveal in terms of the plot, because you know
they run more.
God damn it, Dave, what did you think of these this, especially the first episode, but the rest that we watched?
I didn't hate it. My main problem with the first episode was that I didn't get a sense that these two had a engaging enough past that they would want to do what they're doing in the present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They seem to be very aloof now, mm-hmm. and they didn't really explain like what was so great before, just that they had a relationship before and they made this wacky pact, the run pact. But beyond that, I did like the show more as it went along, actually, because it does introduce some Fargo-esque-ness to their adventure.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. And I have to say, I'm glad I watched all five of the screeners provided, not to be too spoilery about it. But I will here throw in the most cliche line in the scripted TV canon, which is, the season is not actually a TV show at all, but a 7-part movie. Well, sorry. But in this case, I felt like it actually was in a way, because I think in this way that critics, who seem to be reacting better to this show than I would have expected, might have it a little bit better than viewers of HBO. Because mm-hmm. this isn't actually a show that seems to benefit from a non-binge environment. Like,
yeah,
there
yeah,
are certain elements of the story that unfolded in episode 3 or episode 5 that yeah. shedded light on the relationship from episode 1. And in episode 1, I had no idea what to make of the relationship between the two of them. And when it ended 27 minutes later, I was like, well, the tone is weird and striking, but the stakes feel weirdly low, like mm-hmm. which until you get deeper into the series is actually not the case. But like in the beginning, it's like, oh, it really is just to prove something about their relationship, like inside of this like Hitchcockian artifice of making you feel like there should be a lot more sort of like twists and turns, which actually like should involve like again, spoiler. So, but it was, you know, I felt like from the, if I were only exposed to the first episode of the show, which listeners to this point would have been, I don't think I would have kept going.
It morphs after a little bit, I think, into something more than you would expect from the first one. Because the first one kind of seems like a rom-dramedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then, as I said, it gets a little different after that.
Yeah, it's funny, but because I think I have, in addition to kind of not being wild about it overall, I feel the opposite about it, which is that I felt like the first episode was really strong on details that made the characters and their relationship feel, even if we didn't necessarily buy it, and I agree with Sarah that like the leads are doing, both of them, not just Merritt Weaver, although especially her, because especially her always, but both of them,
yeah.
Their performances, I think, are papering over a lot of flaws in the material. Yes. But in that first episode, we get things like, for example, Ruby bringing up the detail of Billy when they were in college thinking that therefore her in her suit.
Yeah, that was good.
Which was
her suit. Who's Fiona? Yeah, that was good. Yeah,
right. Or that she's like always been her own best audience for her jokes. And then in the subsequent episodes, I feel like the character stuff kind of falls away in favor of like more propulsive kind of bonkers plot stuff. So it sort of felt like, you know, if you were here for one or the other, depending on where you were in the season, you would like it more or less.
You know how much I hate 12 hours earlier.
Yes.
This show actually could have used a jump forward, jump back.
Mm.
And there is a moment where they depart the train in a dramatic fashion after the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
That should have been the start of the show.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then rewind to the run.
Yeah.
Yep. Work back to that. And that's only like a 2-episode back and forth. And after that, linear, please.
Yeah.
But that would have painted a better picture of what to expect from the series during episode one. And you really only needed that one moment. Like, why did they leave the train like that? That was weird.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Back. So you know there's more to it than them just meeting on a train and figuring out, will they, won't they, friend style, you know?
Yeah.
I agree. And I think that's what I liked maybe more about the later episodes, is that I didn't mind some of the world building and additional elements of story that they brought on. It's like, of course the performances are great. Like, I probably don't need to be the first person to point out that Merritt Weaver is talented. But like, it took me so long to buy into the dynamic between the two of them that I actually thought that each of their dynamics with Archie Panjabi are arguably more crackling than they were with one another. Mm. I was actually listening to an old episode or extra, and Sarah, I think, asked whatever became of Archie Panjabi, and look, we found her. Like, and she, I felt like the, at least sort of like the twisty mystery narrative that she brought into it was a lot of fun, that gave it, like you said, that sort of like propulsive element that did, you know, maybe some of the more intricate details of the dynamic between the two main characters were like a little bit left behind as the story started to get a little more crazy. But I think that I was fine with that because I needed more information from that first episode to be able to buy into why I needed to care so much about these two characters to begin with.
It's superficial, but I think one of the things that might have helped everybody buying or getting into that relationship, if they let him speak with his accent.
He does. What are you talking about?
Really?
That is his accent.
It seemed tame to me. I thought it was heavier.
No, he's Irish.
Oh, okay.
No, I was actually weirdly sitting next to him at a Fluvog trying shoes on. That's what he sounds like.
Okay.
I had to be told who it was, actually. He left and the clerk is like, thanks for being cool. And I was like, what? She's like, you know, because Donald Gleason. I was like, I don't know who that is because I don't deal with the Harry Potter verse that much. I was like, that's why I was cool. Didn't know who it was, which Tara can attest. Classic Buncey celebrity non-sighting. Anyway, that's what he sounds like.
Okay, my bad. Well, then there's, forget it. I'm not watching another episode.
Fridge is oi, potato lad. Are you guys going to keep going?
I mean, there's only 3 more episodes, so I feel like at this point it's, you know, sunk cost situation. Yes, I will. Will you?
Probably for the same reason. And also, like, I just like spending time with Merritt Weaver.
Yep.
Yeah.
So where they leave it at the end of the 5th episode is like, all right, this should have probably happened sooner.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And also says, I dare you to stop watching, but you can't do that with 2 episodes left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think 3. I think it's 8 in total, I believe. I always feel like, you know, as a culture, are we doing enough for Merritt Weaver? Generally, the answer is no. and I don't think this is either, but, you know, it's better than nothing. And, you know, I agree. I love to see her. I love to see her act. She's the best. And having committed this much time to it, I will see it through. But I do sort of feel like this maybe wanted to be a movie. Like, this should not have been a show, perhaps.
Direct to HBO Max is what I think this would have been if this came out next year.
Yep.
Yep.
You're totally right. Dan, are you going to keep watching too?
I'll finish it. Yeah. Why not? What else have I got going on?
There's the pull quote.
That's the spirit.
It's time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara.
I have two things today. First, The Good Fight, which returned on CBS All Access. Only one has, I guess we don't say aired, it dropped. The premiere title, which I didn't realize until I was reading something about it today, is The Gang Deals with Alternate Reality. And the fact that they ripped off and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia title format is very funny to me. So the premise of the premiere is Diane wakes up, or actually, no, it starts with Diane watching Hillary Clinton's inauguration in 2017. And then she goes to the office. Everything is normal, but everyone is behaving as though, you know, it's year three of Hillary Clinton's presidency. And no one can understand why she's being so weird and doesn't understand like basic news things. And she is convinced she just had a very, very strange dream about Donald Trump being president. And everyone just keeps laughing in her face and saying, how'd that go? And she, you know, doesn't really have an answer because there is no answer. I think we can all agree. Anyway, there's one very good moment where she's telling Liz and Adrian a lot of the, you know, various items of interest from her Trump president dream. And them sputtering, where were the Obamas in all of this? Like, great question, alternate universe Liz. Cough. Mm. Anyway, Diane Lockhart then finds out that her big new client that she's brought to the firm, and this is great news because they are potentially in financial trouble because of all of Hillary Clinton's new corporate taxes, is Harvey Weinstein. Uh-oh, because in this timeline, all the revelations about him have not come out. So it's interesting because even as Diane, knowing what she knows from her timeline, is trying to sound the alarm about him, all of the pro-women groups and people in democratic power structures are indicating that they've also like heard things vaguely, maybe not details, but they're willing to dismiss them because Harvey Weinstein has been so publicly supportive of feminist causes. He's given so much money, which sounds a lot like excuse making going on in our timeline also sometimes, but also interesting because it's expressly said that in the president Hillary Clinton timeline, women's anger is not a message that sells or a story that women in the democratic power structures want to, you know, communicate. That there's their story is women are thriving and women who are not thriving, women who are abused, will be supported by Hillary Clinton when she gets reelected, which, okay, we can ask some other women how that went when her husband was president.
I thought it was pretty interesting that they put that those thoughts in the mouths of respectively Eames from yeah. Criminal Intent and mm-hmm. Dr. Olivet from mm-hmm. Law and Order Mothership.
Yeah. So it's an interesting butterfly effect thought experiment about how the election of Donald Trump, if it doesn't happen, does not touch off the women's march, doesn't incentivize women to fight back by telling their stories, doesn't boost Me Too, doesn't have all those consequences for a whole raft of men under President Hillary Clinton are doing great. And obviously, events get increasingly dreamlike in the episode because this is Diane's dream. She's lost consciousness after their place was raided by a SWAT team in the season three finale, but she's fine. Kurt is also fine, thank God, which I was almost more worried about. But the way they check if she needs more medical attention is to ask her who the president is, and she starts laughing hysterically, which again, both the end of the episode and how we all feel all the time. So one way to read it is that it's kind of depressing to think there's no reality in which American life is not horrible for whole swaths of people, including the literal dreams of Diane motherfucking Lockhart, and that changing the commander-in-chief actually only has a limited effect on the corruption of that is inherent to all structures of power. But another way to read it is optimistic, which is even in what we can all agree is a horrendous reality, justice is possible if we organize and stay really fucking angry even when people tell us not to, and we can do that, so we should.
Another interpretation is the most masturbatory episode of a very masturbatory series.
That is also
like,
true.
Oh my God.
It is also true.
My eyes have not corrected from the role from the start of this episode. Ugh, hated this episode.
Well, another interpretation, and we'll link this in the show notes.
Also, Make America Great Again, guys, am I right?
Dave.
No.
Angelica Jade Bastian wrote a great piece, a close read on Vulture, about how this episode is a takedown of corporate feminism, which was excellent, so we'll link that as well. my second thing onto a show that is the opposite of that, The Baker and the Beauty. This is a remake of an Israeli format. Yes, Dave?
I was asking if this is a show I was in the room with you.
Yes, and okay. I was just about to ask
what Dave thought of this one.
He only watched it in passing.
I'm cracking my...
I'll let you know when it's your time to weigh in. So the show premise is Daniel Garcia is a baker. He works in his family's bakery in Little Havana in Miami. He's been dating this woman, Vanessa, for 4 years. It's their anniversary. He's going out for a fancy dinner with her. Everyone around him is like, she is expecting you to propose. And then he doesn't. And she proposes to him. Everyone in the restaurant, because she has drawn their attention to this moment, is filming them with their cameras. He says no because he has just in the bathroom happened to meet Noah Hamilton, which I know this sounds like a more interesting story than it is, but Noah is a lady. She's played by Natalie Kelly from the first season of Dynasty, original Crystal. So he turns Vanessa down, and then Noah pulls him into her car and they go on a wild night and blah, blah. They start dating, blah. So I tried to be even-handed about this. It's basically Notting Hill. I tried to be even-handed about it, previewing it for Primetimer, but it actually takes some effort to not just set a show in Miami's Little Havana, but also have your lead's parents, who are characters on the show as well, be Cuban immigrants and yet keep your show completely apolitical, but it is. People are going to compare the show to Jane the Virgin for obvious reasons, but that show was very explicit in its politics, as befits a show set in our era that revolves around a Latinx immigrant community, like, duh. But anyway... Speaking of the parents, they and Daniel's other two siblings, and even Vanessa, who gets more to do as the seasons go on, are much more fully realized than the leads. Dave, why don't you tell us what you thought of the lead guy's acting style, played by Victor Razzak from Raising Victor Vargas?
If you took the leading actor of our generation, Vin Diesel, and extracted any charm that Vin Diesel has, you get this guy. He acts just like Vin Diesel, except he's a wet sock.
Yeah, he's a little more personable than Vin Diesel. He smiles more than Vin Diesel does. Mm. He has more life in the eyes, I would say, than Vin Diesel.
Oh, okay, you want to marry this guy?
No. No. This is subjective, but he is also not that cute to me. I mean, if the model is Notting Hill, like, you know, anyone that you cast who is not Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts is going to be a come down, but this is a real come down. And he is... super short. This woman is supposed to be a model. She's also really short, but he's even shorter than her, and it's ridiculous. But all of that said, it's a perfectly pleasant show to watch. I don't not recommend it, particularly for these times. Basically, it has the dopey wholesomeness of Hallmark product.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of, yeah.
Except that people actually fuck, so if that sounds like what you want more of in your life, it's Monday nights on ABC.
It had the acting ceiling of... Hallmark as well.
Yes.
Is my point I want to get across.
100%. Yeah. Yes. To manage your expectations, that's exactly what it's like. So I reviewed that for Primetimer, which we'll also link in the show notes, as well as I wrote a bunch of stuff for Primetimer. So once you're there, click my name on the post.
You have to mention, I don't know where it was. Somebody replied to you somewhere. Why isn't this show called Beauty and the Yeast?
I did retweet that. That's very good.
Good piece of business. Whoever wrote that, kudos.
Yes, this is very funny. And I also redid a review of What We Do in the Shadows, which, as you're listening to this, comes back for its second season tonight on FX and is just as silly and amazing as it was in season one. I agree. Actually, it is funnier than it was in season one.
Yeah,
some really stupid shit happens in season two.
Yeah, I agree. I'm really enjoying. What's the first one that's going out?
The first one is where Laszlo and Nadia have a new familiar.
Oh, okay, right. Got it.
Okay, well, that's a spoiler, but yes.
All right, I'll just bleep that. Whoa, I wonder what Dave said when that was just bleep. There's two really good episodes coming up. This is Superb Owl.
Yes.
And there is a curse-related episode, which was really great, too. Yeah.
Yes, they're really good.
And they're really sort of world-building a lot this season, too, with the whole Van Helsing angle that they introduced at the end of last season.
Yes. So
it's really good. They're doing so much in like a half an hour with this universe. It's kind of cool.
And it's a hard half hour. Episodes are 20 to 21 minutes. Like, it's not a flabby half hour like you sometimes get. We also should mention before we move on, we brought this up last week, the 700 patron challenge. If we can get to 700 Patreon patrons.
A club of sorts.
A club of sorts. Mm. That's very original, Dave. Good thinking.
Yeah.
If we can get to 700 supporters on our Patreon page for this podcast at patreon.com/extrahotgreat, I will watch Tiger King.
Alone.
And we will do a special episode about it. And Dave and Sarah will also watch things that they will enjoy as much as I will enjoy Tiger King, which is not much. And if
as,
you are
as chosen
Patreon. By our Patreon supporters. So sure. As oh, of this recording, let me just refresh the
otherwise,
page.
It was a good kick in the dick promotion.
Yeah, when you are a supporter of us on Patreon, you get to boss us around a lot. Every fourth episode is a topic of our bonus episodes is a topic selected or suggested by our Patreon supporters. So it's a chance for you to tell us a lot of shit to do. All right. Right now we have 657 patrons. So if we can get 43 more supporters by the end of this month of April, we will do this for all of you. So go to patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Literally a couple of bucks is all it takes for you to support us. And we know these are difficult times for a lot of people.
But this podcast has been certified virus free.
That is true.
It's worth saying, actually, the tiers that are like pre-formed start at $2. But if you just really want to watch, listen to Tara watch Tiger King, you could just stick in a buck.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. There you go. So if you have
$2, that's twice as much as I want to spend. Good news.
Great. All right. So 43 more supporters.
Yeah. Between now and basically.
Basically. Yeah. But, you know, we will stop having to do these solicitations sooner than this. Let's do the PBS model. Shut us up. Get over to patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Help us meet this goal, and we will deliver this very important tigery content to you.
Mr. Dan Rogge, what do you got? Something very adult, I'm sure.
Yes, so living in quarantine with a 1.5-year-old doesn't actually allow for a ton of free viewing time, so I decided to treat our mutual viewing project as a binge watch, which is how I ended up watching 20-plus episodes of the current season, season 50, of HBO's finest prestige watch-going, Sesame Street. And since you could shoot an arrow through the middle of the Gen Xer age curve and hit me, we've all known each other too long for me to try to lie about my age around you guys. I'm working with a pretty hard cut from my memory of my early 80s feelings of the show and the 2020 version of it. Let's dig in. I was like, okay, so my first thing, and I know people have talked about this before, but like when Bert and Ernie first met at like Muppet Junior College or whatever, and then reconnected at the Groundlings or whatever their origin story is, I think they never thought that they would just end up as bit players in King Elmo Presents the Incidental Sesame Street Players. And again, I know this is well-trod ground. I have lots of nieces and nephews. Believe me, I know the streets have been talking about this guy since like 1990. But when you are confronted with it as an adult, it is really hard not to feel bad for Oscar and Cookie Monster and the whole gang who have watched this one red menace go full Gladys Knight and the rest of them are just his fucking pips. And side note, who the hell is Abby? What is going on? The rest of the show is largely the same. The theme song is still there. There's nothing HBO-y about it other than expecting the opening HBO sting to actually be followed by the Curb theme, but that's just me. There is this, I'm just thinking of this now, there is this one weirdly like urbane twist of this season that I did want to call out, which is, there's a segment in every episode called All Across America where Big Bird literally went on a cross-country road trip, like in practical terms. He was like meeting kids and finding out fun facts about their towns, and then he Skypes back to Elmo, of course, in every episode so that Elmo can be like, I like meeting people too. And then in the first five episodes of the season, Big Bird is living it up on location in these like iconic towns of like Chicago or San Francisco. And then later in the season, without even mentioning it, he's just mysteriously back on Sesame Street and he and Elmo are Skyping into the towns together, coinciding with what I'll call the iconic caliber of towns like Gatlinburg, Tennessee or Decatur, Georgia. And Big Bird is suddenly like very obviously just like, oh, cool, I'll take a pass on that one in this like hilarious but kind of super relatable way. Anyway,
Big Bird can only visit so many Stuckies before he got bored.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the show otherwise continues its incorporation of celebrities. Chrissy Teigen is on, Dave Grohl. They're very funny. They do self-referential things. Oh, except for Michael Che, the least interesting Sesame Street guest star in the show's 50-year history. I'm putting it out there now. Like, literally, Alana Glazer plays a recurring character named Ms. Noodle, who has zero lines of dialogue, and she does more with it than anything Michael Che did on Sesame Street or on Weekend Update, literally ever. And anyway, everything he says and does is not interesting. The no talent having ass bitch who probably came for Oscar on Instagram after Oscar told Michael Che that sometimes everyone gets grouchy. I don't know. Michael Che sucks. What? Where were we? Oh, yeah. What I will likely do next instead of watching more is show my kid Sack Lunch Bunch, which I have watched like six times, but only with other adults. It actually gets inside of kids' minds better than like any actual kids programming that I have ever seen. In conclusion, Sesame Street.
Wow. I think your next thing is actually the Sesame Street with Jason podcast.
I'm totally in. Oh, he's really into this Abby and Zoe thing. And I'm like, they're not real. They're not real. But he's great. For my plug, jeez, in the absence of live theater, do you need a Broadway podcast to scratch your musical theater itch? Well, look no further than a 3-year-old podcast of a 20-year-old musical, Monica the Podcast, where my Money Can't Buy You podcast co-host Tracy Potocnik and I go song by song, scene by scene through our musical that almost was a singing dancing spectacular based on the Bill Clinton scandal of the late 90s. We made it, and then I had a baby, and that's the last thing I've created besides that and my job. That's Monica the Podcast, wherever podcasts are found. Woo!
Sarah D. Bunting.
It's the moment you've been waiting for 18 months. That's right. Bosh.
So happy for you, Sarah.
I'm so happy for me, too.
You know what I want for you, Sarah? I want, you know, those air, the horns? I want one that goes, bosh, and you can carry around with it.
I think that you just created that. Just like, yep, make that clip, put it in the soundboard. I'm content.
Okay.
I mean, I am also content just with Bosch, which is good at like being contenting, and it doesn't try to do anything more than that. It is back. It is dropping its sixth season this coming Friday, April 17th, the Bosch Eagle. It is back, and it's not better than ever, because that's the thing about Bosch. It's just consistently very good. That's what I love about it. As I wrote on Primetimer last year, it is the grilled cheese, no tomato of programming. Titus Welliver's sideburns are truly an architectural marvel this season. The case is interesting, not too predictable, not too opaque. Maddie, his daughter, is not being a pill. The great Jamie Hector is great. And at this time in human history, Angelenos who have not gone outside in a few days may enjoy this virtual trip through their sunny city, even though it involves homicides and corrupt systems of power. Anyway, like I said, it's back this coming Friday. I've seen the first five episodes. Nothing has changed. And like I said, that's what we like about Bosch.
Homicides, corrupt systems of power, cilantro and everything. Gotta stop with the social commentary. What do you have to plug there, sir?
I have to plug my podcast on true crime. We review true crime on The Blotter Presents. My guest this week is Jeb Lund. That episode will have dropped by the time you hear this, and we are talking about a documentary about the Hart family tragedy, which we hated, and American Animals, about the Transylvania University book heist. Yes, that is a real phrase that is on Wikipedia.
We saw
which
that.
We really liked. So that's The Blotter Presents, wherever you download podcasts, and possibly we'll have a bonus ringtone for you when next we meet.
I have a few things, three quick ones, and then we're going to really complain a lot about Picard at the end of this. Sarah D. Bunting, did you watch the Netflix series The Valhalla Murders?
I did not. Should I?
Well, here's the thing. It's a serviceable Nordic noir, which I guess is the genre that they decided to give it a title. It's a weird spot because I think that genre is sort of petering out. Like, I think that's sort of people are bored of it with now. They get it. And this one seems to be the one where they're like, let's get back to basics, you know, and let's like debonkerify that whole tone to a right. certain extent. Anyways, it's
some of the crimes have bonkers aspects.
They're
would
a
say.
Little gory, but the whole series of events is something that actually could happen.
Right. Yes.
It's true. Not like a
it's
body
like
being cut
yeah.
in half on the international border of a bridge.
Yes.
Kind of thing.
So it's like Bosvik.
It takes place in Iceland, so it's the first one of those shows I've seen. Something takes place in Iceland, which was Dan Rogge.
Yes, I was going to say.
Fan.
Bjork.
And one episode of Black Mirror.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. The weird thing about this series is that the lead detective character is a really terrible cop. And they don't really present her as a terrible cop. She just does dumb things again and again, yet she kind of is like portrayed sympathetically and not like it's not like S.H.I.E.L.D., like she's the corrupt cop
right.
or whatever. She just like makes bad decisions. Like she, yes, Star?
I was just going to say, in the first episode, she gets passed over for a promotion and the longer the season goes on,
yeah,
you're like,
good choice.
Yeah, good goal.
Yeah. And they're painting that to be like this brave injustice. And you're like, yeah all right, I mm-hmm. get it. Mm-hmm. The weirdest thing about this show was that there's this whole storyline with her son, and was he at a party where this rape took place, and if so, was he involved? It's building and building, and then like they don't mention it for an episode, and then it comes back, and like the dialogue is there, like you missed something very critical about this storyline, like it was cut out.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's like, oh yeah, he wasn't involved, we found out or whatever,
right?
And it's just like, wait a sec, did we fall asleep and not like, but no, they just right. don't address it. Like
right,
the mechanics of it. Cause she finds like evidence that he was there and probably filming it.
Yeah. The crisis about that is like, it's a secondary plot thread is like, is she going to destroy evidence and cover this up? Cause it's her son.
Yeah.
And then they're like, shrug. Sort of like, I don't know if I think that's so great, especially given what the A crime is.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, anyway, is it worth watching? Sure. I wouldn't say it's not worth watching.
But it's not appointment television. You could like
put it at the bottom of your list.
It's a 4 to 6 o'clock Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
I got nothing to do kind of show. You'll knock it out in a couple weekends.
Right. Gotcha. And it's on Netflix, so like it's never going to expire. So if you watch 2 and then come back to it 3 years from now, it'll still be there.
On the Netflix crime show streak, Money Heist Part 4, which is just season 2, the second. I don't know how they're doing it. It's annoying. Can we just agree that we'll call things seasons? And if they're in 2 parts, we just continue with episode 5. I hate that. Grr.
Yeah.
So this is the second part of the second heist. So the first 2 seasons were the first heist, and then they started season 3 with the next heist, and this is the second half of that. Expecting it to be done in 2 parts, just like the first one, apparently not. Here we are at the end of the second part of the second heist, and it
ain't
over.
Yeah.
Very annoying. And there was so much filler in this back half. Like there was this big chunk of the story that is like this cat and mouse game between this escaped security guard and the gang. And it isn't what I want out of Money Heist. Like for Money Heist, I want plans within plans within plans, and all of them have to be overplanned, and I want them all to be pretty much impossible, yet somehow they work because the professor is neat.
Yeah. The problem with this is like, it wasn't until, honestly, 3/4 of the way through the last episode that I was like, they're not going to fucking wrap it up. And I got so angry because like, this is a sacred trust. You know, if the first half, if the first essentially season was 16 episodes, season two is going to be 24 episodes. Fuck you. Yep. First of all, second of all, as Dave said, there's like, there's this cat and mouse thing, which is definitely a problem. But in addition to that, there's so many scenes where it really seems like people are just sitting around where it's like, where are the hostages right now? Who is guarding them? Like, there's so many scenes where it's like all of the heisters are together. It's like, who is watching these people?
Well, they have like red shirt.
Eventually guys. You find that out, but it's like, okay, so there's
and
two
by red
people.
Shirt, I mean disposable Star Trek people, because they're all in red jumpers on the show.
Yes. Anyway, this was definitely, speaking of flabby, it's definitely much flabbier than season one.
The first heist was so good.
It was so good.
Here's what they should have done with the second season. Rio should have been in prison, and it should have been a prison breakout, but just as complicated and professorinian as the break into the Mint in the first one.
Yeah.
That would have been great. Rather than just sort of like doing the same thing again and trying to figure out a different way to do it, which was more action, which was the wrong choice.
Just a little side shade too. There was an article on Decider last week that was like, Alicia Sierra is the person I want to be when I grow up. Who's the, like, the cop, the pregnant cop.
What?
Exactly. She fucking tortured a guy. She buries him alive, we find out. Like the back
half of these sins. Do you?
Yes. It's like it's like that hire more women guards tweet, except someone wrote this article for real. So get your shit together, Decider. I know you're owned by Fox, but Jesus Christ. Okay. Mm. Back to Dave.
The next show I want to talk about is Devs. Now, first, Tara. Tara now hates this show, so Tara, I'm going to throw it to you first to find out why.
I don't have really much. The show's just up its own ass. This show should have been a movie, too. It's like the first 5 to 10 minutes of every episode is just like moody, atmospheric bullshit. It's like, get on with it! It's like, it's a dumb show that thinks it's smart, and I have no patience for that. And like, I'm going to see it out because now at this point there's only one more episode, but I hate it.
You covered everything I was going to say, except I'll just read my end point here. I'm curious how it ends, but I get the feeling the show thinks it is way deeper and more meaningful than it actually is, which is a nice way of saying up its own ass. The only other point we have to make at this point is kudos to the show for thinking of ways to get the female lead in her underwear a good 50% of the time. I don't know if we mentioned that on the show, but Jesus Christ, guys, give it a rest. Just make like make another show called The Underwear Show where it's just like, it's that. Because it's really stretching it on this one.
As it were.
All right.
Thongs.
Picard. Picard. So lots of spoilers coming up if you haven't finished it. So
it ended a couple weeks ago. So at this point, I feel like fair game. But
fair warning.
Sure.
I enjoyed the first episode that we reviewed with Mo Ryan on the show. And I enjoyed seeing like the world outside of the Starship Bridge, you know, in this time period. That was interesting. The stuff on Earth, him going to, even though it was San Francisco, him going to Starfleet and, you know, all that kind of stuff was kind of interesting. And, you know, the premise of Data building a daughter was pretty retcorny, you know, but retcorny TM, if nobody said that before. But let's just go with it for the sake of the series, right? But, oh my God, this show took forever to get to the fucking point. Like, first episode and the last episode, bookend, 2 episodes worth of material in the middle.
Yeah.
It was like 10 episodes. Oh my God. Yeah. Like, Picard meets Data's daughters, and the Romulans sure seem to hate those daughters. The androids, as a whole, in the Starfleet area of the universe, sort of hit this singularity moment where it lets them make a long distance call to an even more advanced race of robots to come and save them from humanity by probably killing all of humanity. And humanity here is more than humanity, but they keep on saying humanity, but whatever.
Which, by the way, humanity, even the future, has it coming. Just do it. Like, the robots want it more and they deserve it.
They did. And so they're making this phone call to call the robot exterminators. And at the last moment, because you gotta be the change you want to see, I guess, they end the phone call. And part of this is Picard sacrificing himself to show that humans are great. Thumbs up, teeth glint, ding. And then he's dead. Oh no, they pulled a Logan. Spoiler. But then they bring him back in a brand new, super jazzy, latest model robot body. He's exactly the same. He's an exact copy of Picard's brains and memories and love of certain types of tea at the time of his death. And this body somehow will let him age, and it's going to let him die when he was supposed to, if he didn't die 2 minutes ago when he died.
Yeah.
Ugh. And that, never mind that, like, totally negates the whole sacrifice he just made for the sake of humanity, asterisk. But, like, I realize we got a second season to make, so fuck that idea. Like, that was the end. Like, well, maybe this is it. This is Picard's moment. And this is how he goes out saving the universe. Nope. Robot Picard, season two. Just hated it. And it's also right at the end of the show. Like, he's got this motley crew that he's, you know, that does those filler episodes in the middle. And right at the end of the series, Seven of Nine and Rafi, like, have this... You know, everybody was mad about Rise of the Skywalker's lesbian moment where it's just like... Mwah! Skinner off screen. They have one of those where it's a non-telegraphed lesbian relationship, and right at the end there's like
they touch fingers.
Like, guys, don't do that. If you're going to do a season two, give us its due and actually explore what is going on in season two.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Mm-hmm. It seems worse than doing it in the first place if you're just going to pay lip service.
I can't say lip service when you're talking about lesbians.
As it was leaving, well, here's another one. That whole Enterprise seemed very box ticky.
Oh, no. I'll say this. I want season two of Picard to be like that season of Buffy after they bring her back from the dead and she's really pissed off about it. That should be Picard in season two where he's like, I was happy to be dead. Come on now.
I was so happy that they brought it back because, like, the new Star Treks have been okay in their own right, but they didn't feel tethered to anything.
Yeah.
And I was hoping this one would feel tethered to Star Treks of old.
Yeah.
And it kind of didn't. Like Picard was there, but he was sort of like a sad old man Picard. And that's fine if they want to build a series out of sad old man Picard. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the dude's supposed to be 90-something in the show or something.
Yeah.
So, fine. But it was just out there. And it was just like went on and on, like this segment I'm talking about, Picard. Let's end it. Yes.
All I was going to say is that I read an interview with the showrunners where they were like, their original vision for the show was basically, it was going to be like Picard at his vineyard. And like, sometimes he goes into town and there's little mysteries and he solves them. Or it would have been like Murder, She Wrote, but with Picard. Like, aww. Who wouldn't have rather watched that fucking
show? Is that
show?
Seriously? Wait, is that something yes. they're actually thinking of doing? Or that
I mean,
was just
it was someone's idea at some point, and then Gene Roddenberry's heirs were like, you can't do that. He has to go to space. Right. And they were like, ugh, fine. But that other idea of a show is like so much more fun. It would have been adorable.
Oh my God. It would have been the first Star Trek property I ever finished.
Exactly.
And if they did that, you know who would have showed up? Sir Ian McKellen.
You're so right.
He would either have been like his friend.
1,000,000%.
His doofus friend who helps him solve crimes. Or like one of the, you know, criminals or something.
Bring Derek Jacobi. Play your characters from Vicious. Who's mad at this? Yes. No one.
Man, I'm mad now that I know that actually was out there in the universe. All right, let's end it. some plugs for Patreon and other endeavors of Extra Hot Great on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, which is available to all our supporters on Patreon. We've passed the COVID-19 thing and we're in TV land and we're going to spend our first day of freedom. How? Which TV locations and businesses will we patronize? What will we do there? What will we buy there? How will we enjoy our first day back amongst the TV people? That is on Extra Extra Hot Great. Yes.
We also are going to have another additional Extra Extra Hot Great next week on Tuesday because it's going to be the end of the month. So Sarah, tell us what that is going to be.
That is going to be the Tony Awards, key Tonys from TV, both actors and characters. And there may even be a Tonac in which if we would like to drop a TV Tony into a volcano, we can do so at that time. So definitely join us for that.
Also, we have another Quarantine Helper episode coming this Friday. This Friday, it is Tiny Cannons. Hold me closer, Tiny Cannon, which is all about very small cannons. We got sketch cannons, commercial cannons, repeating gag cannons, and dealer choice cannons. It was a fun episode.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was a good one. And then next week on EHG Prime, we welcome back Mr. Joe Reed for a celebratory ABCs of Television episode, because there's nothing else on, so yeah. We're doing this special episode. So join us for that experiment.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
Sean is not a crackpot, and he writes, and I quote, "Sometimes I watch shows for only one storyline, like The Society on Netflix. I've rewatched for the gay storyline, skipping everything else. I would also like to rewatch Game of Thrones for Arya Stark scenes only. With digital technology, we should have the option to watch a single storyline or character and skip the rest. Streaming services should offer these options for popular shows. I am not a crackpot." Sean, I agree, and I have three shows that I will start with that I would use this feature with, and then I'll throw it, and we'll go around the horn to the rest of the group. First, the show no one watches but me, Dynasty on the CW. I'm the last holdout. Hello, everybody. This is the show where I would fuck Adam, the son that came back from the dead, and his weird teeth. Fuck that guy. Fuck Dominique Devereaux. And all of the people in her storyline, I can't keep them straight. There's like some kind of Love and Hip Hop thing happening now. No one cares. Killing Eve. Fuck Nico. Fuck him. How is he still on the show in season three? Fuck that guy. And finally, the one that I'm curious to see if anyone agrees with me and also had it on their list, Downton Abbey. Fuck the Bateses. Fuck you and fuck you.
I had that idea, but yes, that's a negative of what he's asking. He's not asking what would you take out. He's like, what's the one thing you would watch?
Oh, well, I'm saying that's what I would skip.
Right.
Okay. Let us throw to our guest, Dan Rogge.
So, another story. As a hardcore South Shore Long Islander who graduated from high school in the go-go 90s, I always say that when other people hear silence, I just hear the low hum of old Jews complaining. It's just a frequency I can plug into easily, if that makes sense. So more specifically to this condition, if you sit in a quiet room with me, you can just perceptively hear Seinfeld dialogue emanating from my pores. But my husband, who is a little younger than me and from the Pacific Northwest, did not know anything about it. So dutifully, back in the before times, last year, we watched the entire series beginning to end in its entirety. And in all nine seasons, or really all seven seasons, and then whatever it was that happened after Larry David left in seasons 8 and 9, we have identified an actual number one single funniest scene in the entire series, in which George and Elaine strategize on a plausible lie that George can tell Susan when he wants to sneak off on a Saturday afternoon for a tryst with Marissa Tomei, also known as the importer exporter scene. It's been pointed out to me that the entire sequence is just two writers having a fight about the writing process and then transcribing said process and putting it in the mouths of their characters, which is exactly what it is. It's 3 minutes of perfection and the comedy chops on display between the two of them in the absence of Jerry, and definitely Kramer, the show's Elmo, makes me want to see what a mid-90s Jason and Julia would have been capable of on their own. They are also the subject of another one of Elaine's finest Seinfeld moment, where she throws George's toupee out the window and screams, "I don't like this thing, and here's what I'm doing with it." So I'm voting for a Seinfeld without Seinfeld, and definitely Kramer, of just George and Elaine scenes. Amazing. To see what the series looks like wherever they may be buried.
I love it.
That's pretty good.
Sarah.
It's like Garfield without Garfield.
Yep. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I would definitely be using it to skip like single storylines versus teasing out single storylines. But since like using that rubric, speaking of Call the Midwife, I would do that for plots involving Fred. The downside of this feature, though, is that I would also be tempted to use it on Sister Monica Jean, except sometimes those pay off really beautifully. So if you don't have the whole season of Groundwork and you haven't seen her steal cake the other 49 times, like the 50th time when it's really touching, then you might not cry. Just kidding. You will cry. It's called The Midwife. Who are we kidding? I would go back and excise Rose Leslie plots from the old The Good Fights. Mm. And but I was really thinking that reality shows could use this. Like, there, you know, there's like 48 minutes of Survivor that I don't need. Sure. Yeah. Already using the fast forward button, but why not even eliminate that step? I don't need to see the challenges. I just need to know the outcome. And this is particularly useful for seasons of The Real Housewives, particularly last season on Jersey. Like, do we have to have another discussion about how Joe Giudice is a piece of shit? No, we don't. Click. Do we actually believe that Melissa is considering having another kid? No, we don't. Click. So I really feel that some quote unquote unscripted reality programming could use this feature. So yeah, you are not a crackpot.
Well, Sean, I think your idea is a spiritual brother to my TV Red Zone thing that I keep on bringing it up every now and then.
Yep.
Which is the NFL's highlights only as they happen service. I don't even know if it's still around, but it's kind of a brilliant idea, which is, I ain't got time for all these sports. Just give me the touchdowns. Mm-hmm. So I thought about it, and first of all my answers were like Yuritar. I was doing like, I don't like this part of this show, so I took it out, and Bates was totally one of those answers.
Sure.
But then I realized I got to do the other way. So here's my three. It's an X-Files with just crazy Mulder and no dissenting opinions.
yeah.
Which would be kind of like Ancient Aliens, kind of.
Of course.
Ancient Aliens and autoerotic asphyxiation jokes. Which would be kind of fun. My second is Mr. Peanut Butter and Hollywood, which is just Mr. Peanut Butter stuff. Not that BoJack Horseman's stuff isn't good, but on a rewatch and you want something lighter, for the most part, Mr. Peanut Butter will provide.
Yep.
It's certainly where you get all the sign jokes.
True.
So it's got
and
that
t-shirt
going for
jokes
it.
As well.
And it blunts this criticism that the show isn't funny, which is like always been such an unfair knock. But the Mr. Peanut Butter spinoff within, I'm so here for it.
Yeah. My final choice, Orphan Black Allison, which is just the domestic Orphan Black doing her shit in Toronto.
Yes, with Donnie. Love Donnie.
Burying bodies, getting groceries, and that's the show. I mean, that works for me.
Yep.
By the way, just for people who also love Allison and Donnie, seek out the episodes of Comedy Bang Bang, the podcast, with Tatiana Maslany and Christian Brune, who play them, because they are hilarious, and they usually also have Paul F. Tompkins on them.
Well, I'm glad we've heard from Sean in I'm Not a Crackpot and never will hear from him again.
Hey, Extra Hot Great. This is Sean. What? And I'm submitting for the canon America's Next Top Model Cycle 17 Episode 8 game from 2011. It seems like Tyra comes up with ideas for a show by watching other shows and copying them. So this season, she brings back models from previous seasons for All Stars. They're instructed to capitalize on their brands. And their brands, Kayla gets Proud Lesbian, Lisa gets Wild Child, Allison gets Quirky Doll, Laura gets Country Cutie. Previously, a contestant has been tasked to portray an elephant in a photo shoot to go along with her weight gain storyline, and a budding lesbian has to do a lingerie shoot with girls instead of guys. So this is something Top Model always does. In this episode, they're going to expand their celebrity by going viral, which is treated like the Sesame Street word of the day. So reason one, this should go in into the canon, is classic judge and mentor lineup. You have to have Tyra, Mr. J, and Nigel Barker. So clip one, Jay assigns them their challenge.
You guys are going to get 20 minutes to hear your instrumental music tracks. And in those 20 minutes, you have to write your lyrics to those tracks.
So they get to make a song, and this is probably the same process used by the Real Housewives. And writing a song is a standard challenge on RuPaul now. Lisa's totally confident she's going to win because she's already a rapper. So reason two, being the canon, real life drama intercedes in reality TV drama.
I don't know, in this music challenge, it's just, I can't sing. It's excellent for people who sing. I don't sing.
Allison knows she can't sing and unwisely writes a song about her dead father like the true high school goth girl she is. In another episode, she names her perfume Honeyblood, so this is very, very on brand for her. Then Tyra comes up with a new made-up word. Since coining the word smize, she's been chasing it ever since, and making up nonsense words like booch and booty tooch.
What Tyra wants us to incorporate into every song is pot lead-em. That's top model backwards.
Allison gets upset because her song about her dead father now has to have the word pot lead-em in it. And then reason number three, there are stupidly catchy songs made with producer magic. A lot of these girls can't sing, but the producer make even Lauren and Shannon's track sound palatable. Videos are budget copies of famous music videos or generic one-shots with little thought put into it. Shannon's Faith Hill ripoff, Lisa's not quite good enough to be a Black Eyed Peas track, and Angelique's track is a kind of lackluster hip-hop stripper track. Reason four, we have to have Tyra being wildly over the top.
Pot lead-em, what's up? Now you know that superstar singers always have somebody featured in their video, you know, their posse backing them up.
That's right. So I thought it would add a lot more excitement to your videos if Tyra was in them.
But I can't support you alone, especially looking like this. I need somebody that has had over 100 million hits on YouTube. I need Keenan Cahill. Get your butt in here, boo.
The celebrity brought in for this episode is Game, a rapper, to direct music videos. And then in probably my favorite interaction in the whole episode is him with Allison Harvard. So reason five, the Game is totally taken by Allison.
You are weird. And it is the greatest thing in the world for you. You are the most weirdly beautiful person that I've ever seen in my life. And your eyes, they're weird too, but they're great.
The video was mesmerizing. It was very soothing. There's something that penetrates me emotionally with this. It's touching something inside of me.
Ultimately, Lisa's rap can't beat the otherworldliness of Allison's song about her dead father. And the winner is Allison, because the Game loves her weird, quirky girl thing. I love this episode mostly because of Allison's weird girl earnestness and the Game's infatuation with her. Plus, I get her song stuck in my head all the time. And everybody's at their best. Tyra's over the top. Jay is snarky. Nigel's into it. And the girls are all trying very hard to jump through the crazy hoops that Top Model throws at them. So that's my pitch. I hope more people have a love of Allison's music video Underwater about her dead father and enjoy the time when Top Model was actually a good show. Don't hate me, Dave.
Well, let's start with Dan because he picked this off the list.
Okay. So, and again, me. So in the early days of an old website called Television Without Pity, I recapped the first two seasons of a groundbreaking reality series called America's Next Top Model. Well, it turns out the executive producer of the show was a fan of that website. So like the starlet who got discovered at the drugstore, and with a huge assist from the great Heather Cox, I was, as you know, ferried off to LA in 2004 and started working on ANTM as a producer for Cycle 4. I have seen all of the episodes of the show a couple of times. And this was a very fun one to watch again. And look, I get it. Like, even the best episodes of this series kind of toe that line between canon and no-nack in a way that it's like so ridiculous and so high camp that there are frequent stretches where you don't know if you're laughing at or with the show, like even in the best of times. Like, we all culturally made fun of Tyra for making up Smize, and then everyone was like, Smize LOL, but then the 180 irony camp line was crossed without even realizing it, and then everyone was saying Smize for whatever year that was. For me, it was still this year. So that's the context. And all of that said, I feel like everybody knows the best episode of ANTM is from season two when Shandy cheats on her boyfriend while they're in Italy. I don't know what the actual title of the episode is, but I just call it You Had Sex. That's the title. And I know this sounds like a joke to even say that that would have been like the finest moment in 20 plus seasons of a modeling competition, but it indicates to me like what the best episodes of this series actually possess, which is a real and authentic moment, like of character, like something in the verite, just like in the footage where the narrative of the show kind of like gets away from itself in a way that even the show wasn't expecting. And we learn something unexpected about who the girls are, what makes them interesting or funny or quirky or dark outside of the prescribed beats that the show is giving to you. Like in Game, we learn that Allison is dark and brooding, but it's playing within the rules of the show, right? It's manufactured within the process beats of the episode itself, which is very nicely done from a producer perspective, but it's on rails. It's not shocking or this OMG moment like in the world of the series. And in fact, most of what they do well and not well in the challenge kind of reinforces to me the most familiar aspects of their personality. It's like Lisa is a performer, and in the challenge she performs well, just not well enough. And like there is also the beat right where her fiance comes to visit, which also was this available just pod for verite and something to happen, a twist on the typical beats of the show, and nothing really happened. Like Potlidum is quite an attempt to be iconic and catchphrasey, and like the submission said, it is chasing the Smize dragon in some ways, right? Yep. It's like, I was extremely entertained by this episode. The music videos I thought were very fun to watch and to make fun of. But you know, again, the show ultimately feels sort of like a beat for beat recitation of sort of a plug and play Top Model episode. It was a fun watch. This was a great presentation, but I think if you fall asleep in front of an entire season of Top Model episodes on your couch, which God knows I have done many times, this one does not particularly stick out of the pack for me.
Wait, before we move on, I just want to ask Dan, if you've been listening for a long time, you know Dan also worked on RuPaul early seasons. He was the one that
on
coined
Drag Race.
He was the one that gave RuPaul "Don't Fuck It Up."
Yeah.
Yes.
For real. So comparing Potlidum to other great catchphrases the world has seen, where do you rank it? You know, like percentile.
Oh, I think that this will be, I look forward to contributing my first decider article. You're welcome. And I think that this, again, it's like she had gotten so deep inside of the Tyra crazy at this point. Like when she was, this was after the talk show, like, but she was still so famous and coming off of this, like, you know, like covers of the New York Times magazine where it was like Oprah, Martha, Tyra, like she was in full I am a brand mode. And so once you sort of like, you know, I feel like this was like the spinning in the later, because this was one of the later seasons of the show too, that it was like, Smize felt like it came from a very like particular institution and it spoke to modeling. And when she, like, Potlidum felt like it was definitely an original. It came from the brain of Tyra, but it didn't really, it did nothing for the songs, of course, and just felt like it was so random that I felt like I would put it a little bit lower on the list.
If I may translate, Smize is to I didn't do it.
Yes.
Potlidum is to Wobble Wobble.
Is what? Yes, exactly. Exactly.
All right, I'll go next because I want to build on something that Dan said, which was when he's talking about Potlidum trying to chase the dragon of fetch, and of course with what Sean the submitter said as well. It this is of a piece with where we're starting from in this episode, but also in this season, which is like we're going to make a viral video, which is
right.
That's not how virality works. In like you can't manufacture it, and like when you're like Rebecca Black, it's like that's not what she set out to do either. Like you can't decide you're going to do this, and there's nothing more like craven and thirsty and grasping and like repellent than trying to do that. And like the fact that Rebecca Black is like the exemplar for that, even in 2011, where like I feel like that was a whole year after the Friday video, even. It's like, I mean, this whole thing feels like it's from 5,000 years ago. It honestly feels like it's from like it's been excavated from like an archaeological site. Truly, it's like has so
helped by the poor transfer. How it kind of looks it was from a video.
Oh my God! Yes.
Yeah. Bad. Yeah. You know, Sean's point is well taken. Allison's track is strangely hypnotic. Like it is catchy, even with better than some of the other ones. She does work in Pot Lead 'Em in a way where it's like, if you heard it, you'd be like, what? But then you would just keep going because it doesn't sound like anything. Even when she sort of breathes like top model backwards, it's just like all of the number of people that felt like they had to say that, like, just say Pot Lead 'Em. It was not required that you explain what it is. It just sounds like nonsense syllables. Like, just put them in there and keep moving. That said, once you actually hear her track, it makes you flash back to the moment where the producer is like going around and looking at everyone's lyric sheets. And then he goes to Allison and he reads this and he's like, this is really meaningful to you. And then you realize later what he was looking at was 1, 2, 3, 4 underwater. Like, how did he get there from what was actually on her page? Like, there's just nothing there. And yet somehow, weirdly, it works.
2.5 hours slotted for his appearance. Bing, bang. Boom, we're out of here. That's great. Way to go, Allison.
I know. And then, as Sean also said, like, Tyra inserting herself in this stupid, over-the-top way with poor Keenan Cahill, who, like, I mean, I'm sure he had better things to do, but, like, the challenge of making the models have like, okay, you're supposed to like make this video like
so
hot
many
and
things
sexy.
Involved with this 18 things in one.
Absolutely. But like, if so they're bad. Like, okay, so you're Beyonce, go be Beyonce, and then cut in with like the two of them acting like fucking clowns in their dumb costumes, like mugging for the camera. It's like so undercutting what we're supposed to have been presented as them as trying to do.
I couldn't figure out at the end, the start, the middle, the end of this episode.
Yeah.
If Tyra Banks is like an entertainment genius or one of the world's dumbest people.
Yeah.
Like it's on the edge of everything. Is this canon? Is this known as? Like, is Tyra Banks
is she a
functional
genius?
Adult? Or does she poop her pants?
Is she an imbecile? We don't know. We'll never know. We will never know. Anyway, all that said, it wasn't unenjoyable to watch, but I agree with Dan that this didn't feel like this didn't feel like one that, even though it was from like the era after long after I had stopped watching the show, this wasn't one that I feel like had broken through as a moment for the show. And I, as enjoyable as it was to watch as like an art, you know, as a document, I don't know if this is ANTM canon material for me. Sarah.
I feel like there should be a canon of the most like craven reality show competitor bullshitting about whatever good idea they're supposed to be promoting. I will refer explicitly to last week's product placement of Trolls the World Tour featuring Kelly Clarkson on Top Chef.
Ooh.
What the fuck?
Oh no. Oh,
dear. Like, it's not my first week watching TV either. And it was like, guy.
Can we have a troll sidebar for a second?
Yeah.
Does this work back to Trolls on Top of Your Pencil hair thing?
Uh-huh.
Is this the same thing?
Yes.
That's the franchise. Yep.
Okay. That's all I really wanted to know.
Okay, good
I'm surprised.
I mean, look, I think that Alcoholic Beach is rocking like a 9% on Rotten Tomatoes right now. We could talk about that if you need to. I would like to talk about like Pot Lead 'Em is the dumbest. Like, a lot of the contestants on Top Model are from like, they are more than happy to go with the story that Tyra is a genius fairy godmother who is going to lift them out of horrible circumstances, because like, she actually did that for a lot of young women and men later on in the show's life cycle. I think that some of it is sincere, but to watch an all-stars season of these women having to like perform making sense of Potlatum, and then that there's, you know, there's the game. Like, how much money did you lose at poker that this was discharging the debt? Like, buddy, what are you doing? And then he's like audibly getting a boner for Allison, which was kind of charming. I agree.
Yeah.
In its complete and utter weirdness. Mm-hmm. But this, despite this episode being utterly on brand for this kind of Tyra foolishness that is like on the razor's edge of camp, where she's like, yeah, it's top model backwards, and everyone's just like blank, and then they have to seamlessly transition into selling that concept, and then there she is in a t-shirt with weird pigtails. Like, nobody has ever had less of a sense of humor than Tyra Banks.
Yeah.
Name one fucking person. Like, Stalin was hilarious. Like, at least he could tell a knock knock joke. She has no idea when things are funny.
Yeah.
Knock knock. And knock knock.
Who's there?
Who's there?
Stalin.
Stalin who? Wow, that's okay. Pretty good.
Quit Stalin. Take a vote. So yeah, look, this is extremely on brand. Like, in a top model canon,
yeah,
I think this could go in, because the Potlatum thing is exactly the like turgidly and insistently unclever bit of Tyra quote yeah. genius unquote that she is known for. Like, talk about branding. That yeah. is hers. Does this episode rise to the level of her screeching at Tiffany? I don't think it does.
I think you mean, does it smize to the level?
Yeah. I still really enjoyed watching it, and I enjoyed the presentation, and I completely get where Sean was going, mm-hmm. but...
Indeed.
Yeah. Potlatum. It does get in your head. Fuck.
Well, sounds like the decision is in, but let me make a case for why this show is... this episode is at least worthy in some sense. And in a lot of sense, like,
yeah,
it is obviously over-engineered. like, the show in total is kind of over-engineered, but this episode in particular, the challenges and everything, there's like way too many things happening. Like, why are models writing yeah. their own songs, you know, yeah. and they all have to use the same set. And like, then there's like a nonsense word they have to build into it, no matter what their song's about. Like, there's a lot of weird, dumb shit happening in this episode. But at the end of the day, there is some mwah, choice, grade A cringe throughout this episode that in True. Itself makes me recommend this episode. And I don't like reality shows. I do remember watching the first couple seasons of
yeah,
this when
did.
It came out, you know,
it.
And so I'm familiar with it. This is nowhere near as good as the one, the other one that's in the canon that is the
yeah.
We're Rooting For
we
You
were
episode.
All rooting for you.
Yeah. But go do the cringe stuff. First of all, they have like two child YouTube stars
yeah.
that they rope into this. These kids have no fucking idea what they're doing with these dinosaurs and what this is. They True. Have Madison, the makeup star, mm-hmm. who I looked up at just recently, like within the last few months, stopped her show.
Wow.
Because she got demonetized or something like that. And she was like, this is really sad to do now. I hate it. And she's like going to college now. Oh, well, so
that's good.
I don't know what happened to the kid, but so that was weird. And this is not about this episode in particular, but in the credits, at the end of the credits, Tyra Banks walks to the camera. She's got nothing on her face, and she like rubs her cheek and sticks it in her mouth, and the mouse wants some to the camera. And I was so what? Creepy. Like, what are Ew. You doing? It's like, it was like a cry for attention from the credits.
Yeah.
Potlatum. I think we've all said that Potlatum is one of the dumbest things on TV we've ever seen. One of the things that we're not talking about is that when they're doing the terrible, incongruent dancing and Pulp Fiction-esque two fingers, John Travolta motions with their heads and all that shit, she is wearing like a junior soccer uniform with like ironed on letters that say Potlatum on it. Like, it's
yeah,
Sarah said.
Oh, okay. It's just like it was like going to like clown or elf college, and this was like the school uniform. It was just so bad. But I gotta say, it paid real dividends. Like, hearing those songs that were like, some were good, Some were okay. Some were very bad. But every one of them had to say pot lead them in it. Like, what
Lisa's
the fuck?
Lisa's is pretty good.
Like, why? What the fuck does that do with modeling? You know, in modeling, you're going to have to say a lot of backwards things. What?
Also, why?
I'd also like to note, before we vote, that if there is a no-knack for celebrity child names, Lisa's kids are going in through no fault of their own. They are named Daxel and Venice Sire. Venice Sire's birth was streamed live on Facebook.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Oh wow. My God. Yikes.
Also, why isn't it Leadum Top Pot? Anyway, back to Dave.
The other point about the cringe part of it is, of course, Allison's whole thing. What a weird looking lady. That has nothing to do with it. But I was trying to figure out why, like, she's attractive in a weird way. She reminded, and I was like, what, who? And then I figured it out. It's like every female stop animation Tim Burton lead character.
Yeah,
as a person. Totally. Like Corpse Bride.
Totally. Yeah. And,
The song. So let me just play a little bit of that song again. I think I have it queued up to the right point. Racking my brain, trying to figure out what this really dumb song reminded me of. Had to listen to the song twice. Had to do that thing where you listen with your eyes closed to listen more. And then Tara cracked it. So I was like, I feel like she should be saying, and break, and break. And then I finally realized this song is basically the Tammy song from Kids in the Hall.
Segregation, hibernation, plantation, constellation, Indian nation, and dance, dance.
Like, this is the same song, basically.
Wow.
Less dead father.
Father, you know. Mirror.
That's what father. I said. That yeah. was my mirror. First guess.
Uh-huh.
Oh boy.
Maybe I'm changing my mind.
So this is why I think this episode is worthy in a way. Like, I understand why you're not voting it into the canon, because like it's bad, but not in a like top model-y core competency kind of way.
Right.
It's just tangentially bad, mm-hmm. periphery bad, you know, like why are they singing these songs? These songs are terrible. Great setup for failure. I enjoyed the cringy moments. I never want to see it again. Everything about the Allison song was pure gold.
Yeah.
I get it, Sean. And I get why these three are not going to vote it in. But for my money, for cringe ROI, this episode paid real dividends. So with that, let's put it to the official vote. Mr. Dan Arogi, what say you?
Great presentation, Sean and Dave, but I'm going to have to go no on this one.
And Tara Ariana?
I also, I mean, as Dave said, he sort of summarized my position. This is not among the, for me, iconic moments of America's Next Top Model. As enjoyable as it was to watch and to listen to the great presentation from Sean, but I'm going to vote no.
Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to matter. It's going to be a tie. But Dave, you talked me into it. There's enough references in here that I mean, why not? I'm going to vote yes.
All right.
Tough show to Dave.
I just got to play another clip here just before I vote.
Don't hit me, Dave.
Oh, I see. The only one that went in there in your corner, John, won you a vote. Somehow I'm the monster here. I voted for the last one in the canon. I don't know why I'm the villain here. But I'm going to say yes, which gives us a 2-2 tie. And as we know, ties mean it does not get into the canon.
Yes.
So unfortunately, I am sorry. That means
Hulk spies.
America's Next Top Model. Season/Cycle 17, Episode 8, Game. You are hereby not inducted into the extra Hot Great Cat and Pod League.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and loser of the week. Tara has the winner.
I just want to say, we cannot make Pot Leadum the new Ray Don Chong challenge where we try and sneak it into we can't do it, or can we?
Or must we? I'm gonna
put a post like in between breaths in the song. You just hear, did I just hear somebody whisper Pot Leadum?
Anyway, I have your winner. And your winner is as follows. Amy Schumer, who is going to be starring in a quarantine cooking show for the Food Network. Now, she's in with the winners, but I have to say, and I believe it was James Poniewozik, past guest of the show, who said on Twitter, Ray, this weekend's Zoom Saturday Night Live episode, that as interesting as it is to, you know, talk about what culture means at this moment, that doesn't necessarily, no, it was Sam Adams from Slate. That doesn't mean that we want to see culture that is about this moment in this moment. Like, who wants to be reminded of what's happening by watching a show on my television that is in Zoom? Like, no thank you. You know, like, on the late night shows, fine, I get it, those are meant to be, you know, disposable, they're not supposed to be rerun, you know, even 2 weeks from now. But something like this, like, who would want to watch this? I don't, when I watch TV, I want to be taken out of what I'm experiencing.
I have a question.
Yes, Dave.
Why is this in the winner category then?
Because she's getting a show, and good for her. Okay. I mean, she's on that grind.
Yeah.
Might as well. She's not making a movie right now. Mm-hmm. She also just had a baby. So, you know, might as well make a show. But I don't know why they want to do this and why it's happening. So kind of a mixed bag, I guess.
And loser of the week?
Loser of the week is Lori Loughlin. Probably she and her co-defendants in this college admissions thing thought that COVID would get them off the hook. Nope. She and what's his name tried to get the college bribery case dismissed. That was countered with the release of new evidence of their guilt, and also some really sad pictures of her crotch fruit on rowing machines. You'll be seeing that in The Week in True Crime Buttholes over at bestevidence.fyi if you would care to investigate further.
Speaking about buttholes, I guess. Do you know what time it is? Game time.
Not speaking of rowing machines? Come on, man.
All right, it is the seventh game time of the season. Our scores currently are Tara leading with 3, Value Guest right behind with 2, Sarah with 1. Today we are playing Royalties ROI from Rebecca, who earns herself an extra credit topic. While movies have long used pre-existing pop music to score iconic scenes, scripted television has been a much later adopter. Sometimes those songs become forever linked to their TV moment or characters. In Royalties ROI, I will play you a snippet of one of these songs and the year of the episode it had its moment in. You name the show it was featured on for 2 points. Ask for a clue, and I will give you a description of the scene in question.
Ooh,
after which it is 1 point, only one guess, all right?
Okay.
All right.
Oh no. Elmo's been killed.
Sorry.
Here is an example from 2003 that Rebecca says is dear to her heart. Any ideas there? This would be your 2 point guess.
2003.
All right. Here's the hint that you would get in that case. We discover how a failed middle manager lost his savings becoming a failed singer.
Oh, The Office.
The Office UK. David Brent singing, if you don't know me by now, in the video he made. That's how we play this game. Let's throw it to Tara to see the steel meal situation, please. Good save, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. Steel meal situation is as follows. Sarah D. Bunting has 2. I have 4 plus an extravaganza gong. Valued guest, I'm sorry to tell you, Dan, Adam Sternberg cleared you out last week. You have 0.
You got Reinwald Jones Sternberged. We add to it every time. Let's throw to Pinky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Order today. Tara, Sarah, Dan, are we ready to play Royalties R-O-I?
Yes, sir.
Why?
Starting off with Tara, you'll hear your song, which is from 2009. Identify the show it is from. Remember, if you don't know it off the bat, ask for the hint.
Hey, show chance, take my hand, come with me. It's like I waited my whole life.
I believe this was from Mr. Sarah D. Bunting's canon submission. The Office, America.
Correct, and that is good for 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting, are you ready for your first song?
Yeah.
It is from 2012.
Zooby, zooby, zoo. Zooby, zooby, zoo.
I'm ready to answer, but first I'd like to hear a chomp sound effect. Chomp. Perfect. Thank you so much. Mad Men.
That is good for 2. All right, Dan, are you ready for your first song?
Let's do it.
2005.
I will need the hint for that one.
All right, here's your description of the scene. In the final moments of this show, we fast forward into the future to see the deaths of all the main characters.
Of course, that is 6 feet under.
6 feet under, good for 1 point.
That was 15 years ago, you guys.
Yeah. Fuck.
There's a lot of songs from shows here. I'm like, that was a couple. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yes.
2000, even.
Okay.
Lady, when you're with me, I'm smiling. Give me, whoa, 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 your love.
Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks. Correct. 2 points. Well done. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. Your song here is from 2007, and this might be one of the hardest ones in the game. It's kind of outside her wheelhouse is what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Maybe if you just cut it off in the middle, I would get it. Just kidding. It's The Sopranos.
It is The Sopranos. In case anybody's wondering, Glee was a couple years after that.
I mean, it was also in a Scrubs, but that was not in 2007 either.
Back to Dan. 2013.
Come on, everybody. I say now let's play a game. I bet you I could make a rhyme out of anybody's name. The first letter of the name. I treat it like it wasn't there.
That would be American Horror Story.
American Horror Story, Asylum. Nice. Correct. Nice. 2 points. Tara Ariano.
Yes, sir.
2005. 2005.
Okay.
There's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, because it hangs them up to see someone like you. But you gotta make your own kind of music. Sing your own special song.
Tara, you have my full permission to sing along there. You were mouthing it, but, you know, follow your heart. What is that show?
That show is Lost.
That's the season 2
Only
premiere.
Only good thing it ever did.
So true. Oh. I have this song on my phone. Every time it comes up, it does kind of creep me out.
Think of Desmond?
Yeah.
Back to Sarah. Your Song, 1985. And you know.
Knew it.
Never, never hurt you. I would give at this moment.
Oh my God. If only you would have hurt Brandon. That is Family Ties. Hello?
Hello?
Just waiting for the full show name, Sarah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sha-la-la-la.
See, what Dave doesn't know and what Dave can't know and may never know because he'll never read our book is how many times you have now had to edit the entry where we talk about Billy Vera, who played Brandon's bookie on 90210 really? For reasons no one knows. Yeah.
Weird.
He lost a bet.
So I guess I didn't realize this, and I'm probably the last person on Earth.
Yes.
So I'm going to tell you as if it's new information to me, like a college student learning about psychology or something. But I guess this song was like before this episode, day after this episode, number one on Billboard.
Yes.
Let's see. We're on to Dan. Are you ready, Dan?
Let's do it.
This will take us into our first score break. 2004.
But where was it used? All right, I guess I need the hint.
2004, often used throughout the show run. This was that 2004 is the first one. This song is the soundtrack to The Magician's...
Oh, God, duh, sorry. Arrested Development.
Correct. 1 point. And Tara, we need dem scores, please.
Very close game, Dave. Dan has 4 points. Sarah and I are tied with 6 points each.
Ooh, all right. We have 21 questions today. I don't know if I mentioned that up top, so we're getting about halfway done.
Okay.
Back to it with Tara.
Skipping the equalizer zone?
Yes.
Okay.
Because we've been here for a while.
We have.
It's all that, you know, pot lead-em-ness.
Pot lead-em.
Tara, 2013.
Okay.
That's the song. What's the show?
I think it's Breaking Bad.
Is that your answer?
Yes.
You are correct. Did not hear the baby blue part of that song.
Yes.
Title. Well done, Sarah D. Bunting, 2002. Here's your song.
Hint.
As his wife and daughters frolic on a beach, a beloved doctor succumbs to cancer in his bed.
In the words of Andrew Hsu, what? I'm going to be annoyed, but I don't know this one.
Steel meal.
Steel meal from Tara.
Mark Green. ER.
That is correct. It was ER. That is the song you will always hear when you go into any Long's Drugs in Hawaii. Mr. Rogi, are you ready? This is from 1985.
Be. This classic episode of Benson was... I'm just kidding. I have no idea, hint.
All right. To celebrate their grandparents' 49th anniversary, the rest of the family performs a lip sync on the living room's staircase. 1985.
Cosby.
Correct. Doing the Ray Charles song on the staircase. Correct for 1 point. To Tara.
Yes.
The year is the year 2000. Mm-hmm. This is your song.
He was fat, fat, cat, cool. Like a Friday afternoon martini chilling at a quarter after five. Twist of lime, Coke on the side. The brother loved the high life. Had a PhD in street strife. They called him the Jackal.
Personal attack on Sarah is what it is, first of all. Second is the West Wing.
That is correct for 2 points. Sarah got a problem with that?
She's yep.
Not a fan.
All right, let's see if Sarah is a fan of this from 1984.
Is that a girl's bicycle? It's Miami Vice.
Miami Vice, correct. First album I ever bought. Face value, Phil Collins. Who loves Phil Collins? This guy.
Dave
who
just loves bought Genesis? A Genesis.
This guy.
Just bought a Genesis shirt like within the last 3 weeks.
Trick of the tail, second nice. Best Genesis album. Email me if you want to know the first. All right. Dan Rogge, 2005.
Pot lead him.
Are you ready, Dan?
Yeah.
What you say, that you only meant well, cause you did. What you say, that it's all for the best, cause it is. What you say.
2005. So I saw it. I will take the hint.
All right. After being assaulted by your ex-boyfriend's bad news brother, one of the show's main teenagers shoots him to stop him from killing the brother she loves.
Oh, maybe I didn't see it. All right, who's going to steel mill this from me?
I'll do it.
Okay.
Steel mill from Sarah.
It's the OC.
The OC, correct for 1 point.
See, that was also in Gossip Girl, but that wasn't until later either.
That's why I'm giving you the year.
So smart, Dave.
Yes. All right. Let's hear the scores at this juncture. Everybody has 2 questions left. Tara.
Still a very close game. Dan has 6. Sarah has 9. I have 11.
All right. Everybody with 2 questions left. Tara, are you ready?
Yes.
This is from 1997.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues in the middle of the pouring rain. WC Handy, won't you look down over me?
Hint.
Okay. Our two detectives take the creature of the week to a Cher concert and dance together.
I mean, it better be the X-Files.
Okay. It's the X-Files. That was a great episode ending. To Sarah D. Bunting, we are talking 1998.
So make the best of this test and don't ask why. It's not a question but a lesson learned in time. It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life.
Is it time of your life?
It is not. Here's the hint, just to see if you can get it. No points. The final episode of this long-running sitcom ended with a series highlight reel set to this tune.
Yeah, no, doesn't help.
Dan, you want to get Eric in here so we can answer this question?
I do not have a steel meal and it's Seinfeld.
All right, Dan. 1990.
I want to love you, feel you, who
Here's the song, 1990. What's the show?
Definitely mouthing that one alone in my apartment. Hint.
This tiger got addicted to caffeine pills, making her performance of this tune kind of manic.
Right.
Go ahead. No.
Anybody? It was Saved by the Bell. Oh. And here's the third performance of that song in that episode.
I have to sing!
Just sing! You can't sing tonight!
Yes, I can! I'm so excited! I'm so excited! I'm so scared!
We all learned something.
Lead them.
Brilliant. All right, everybody's last question coming at you. Tara, 2002.
Okay.
If it takes forever, I will wait for you for a thousand summers. I will.
You know, earlier we were talking about how an eye roll of mine took a couple days to get back righted. Tara just started one of hers when she realized what that was from. Tara?
That's Futurama.
That's Futurama. Jurassic Bark episode of Futurama.
To be fair, we have not watched that episode since we got dogs. I haven't.
I still don't like it.
It might feel different
to
me now.
It's schmaltzy.
Well, all right.
All right. That is good for 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting, here is your last song. It is a recent one, 2018.
I think I know it, but I need a hint.
All right. Your hint is, after feeling relief about getting through the border patrol, the spies are shocked to realize their daughter got off the train.
Oh, yeah. That fucker. The Americans.
Good for 1 point. Dan Rogge taking us to the end. Also, 2018.
Eva, why have you engulfed so many hearts? Eva, Eva.
2018, wow. Do you know the show?
No, I'll take the hint one more time.
Following a murder-suicide in a strange mansion where he had just hoped to buy a piano, our character drives his moving van away empty.
Oh, Atlanta?
Atlanta is good for 1 point. That's regulation. Tara, the scores, please.
Our final scores are Dan, 7, Sarah, 10, me, 14.
All right, so let's reuse our tiebreaker for a stew meal for future use.
Okay.
I will play you the song. As soon as you know the show, shout it out. I am not going to give you the year.
Oh.
Are you ready?
Okay.
Everybody's involved in this. Okay. Here we go.
Is it Westworld?
It is indeed Westworld. Painted black by the Rolling Stones on the player piano and then orchestrated behind it. Well done, Tara.
Good job, Tara.
Thanks.
Woohoo!
Tara!
Congratulations, Tara. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Crate. We tried to keep our discussion of the new HBO dramedy Run on track before going around the dial with stops at The Good Fight, The Baker and the Beauty, What We Do in the Shadows, Sesame Street, Bosch, The Valhalla Murders, Money Heist, Devs, and Picard. Sean insisted he was not a crackpot for wishing for a single-story storyline viewing option and doubled down on his pot-leadamosity with his unsuccessful pitch of America's Next Top Model's Game for the Canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Musical Game Time from Rebecca. Next up, we're patronizing TV businesses on the other side of COVID-19 on Friday's Extra, Extra Hot Great. Plus, we got Tiny Cannons on this week's Quarantine Helper. And right here on the next Extra Hot Great Prime, it's Joe Reed and the ABCs of Television. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Underwater,
Sarah D. Bunting,
some masterpieces can't be made in 20 minutes,
and Dan Rogge,
I'll just do it, put leader.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
This is unforgivable.
I know. Really? People forgive all sorts, don't they?
Not this. Who does this?